This is where smart business conversations meet real-world experience, where strategies are shared, lessons are learned, and ideas come to life. I'm Emily Galindo, and you're watching Biz Talk, your destination for real insight from the mind shaping tomorrow's business world. Only on Now Media Television.
Welcome to Biz Talk. I'm your host, Emily Galindo, and on this show, we dive into the real challenges facing business leaders and uncover solutions that truly work. So today I'm joined by Daryl Steed, founder of the Smart Wolf Consulting, with over 15 years of experience helping dealerships optimize fixed operations, inventory strategies, and sales and marketing. Daryl is known for his honest, results-driven approach that boosts efficiency and profitability. His mission is simple: tell the truth, take action, and drive success. Welcome, Daryl.
Thank you for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let's start with one of the biggest challenges dealerships face today, which is inventory headaches. Many dealers feel like they can't find quality used vehicles at good prices, leaving them their lots empty, their profits gone. Why is this happening, and how can they start to change that story?
Well, the big reason that that's happening for a lot of stores is that they became centralizedly focused on getting cars from either trade-ins and or auctions. Well, when we saw what happened with the dynamic shift in COVID of inventory not being produced as much, that then reduced the amount of trade-ins, which was kind of a snowball effect to everything else. Not as many cars being produced, not as many trade-ins, not as many vehicles coming back into the market. So that created a dynamic there. And then they'd always had this shift to go to the auction to get cars. Well, because of the lack of inventory that was built over that 2.5-3 year time frame, everyone's looking for the same amount of vehicles. And when they do that, it then drives prices up. It makes it very hard to find the inventory everybody's looking for. And so you have, 8,000 plus dealers that are operating in the same exact way, not counting independents, which then just immediately changes the dynamic. And so where stores have to evolve, change, or adapt is that they need to look at a different way of going about their business. And where I suggest that most people start is making your stores, instead of a sales first mentality, make it an acquisition first mentality, so that if you have the right cars, you have that mentality, sales doesn't become a problem.
Right, insinuating that if people are there to sell their vehicle to you, they obviously are going to need a vehicle to leave with, right? So you get both sides of the coin is what you're suggesting.
Yes, and we've seen it. I mean, there's obviously the 800-pound gorilla in this industry, which is CarMax, and now Carvana's joined that conversation. And oddly enough, I remember CarMax kind of being laughed at, like people were like, this will never work. And, as we see their publicly traded company, they're laughing at everybody now because it's worked very successfully. And same with Carvana, they continuously having record profits. And it's one of those simple plans of they just made acquisition and consumer experience their priority, and sales came because they have the vehicles. It was just a simple supply and demand. If we have them, they'll come get them. But they stopped trying to do the old school methodology of like, we sell something. It's we buy something. So they made that consumer first mentality.
Okay. And so what's a simple action that a pre-owned dealership right now, I guess it could be a brand new one, but acquisition is a part of the trade-in value, is a part of your resale funnel, right? And so what's one thing that they can do to create that acquisition first mentality or consumer first mentality?
Well, the first would be is like widen your acquisition strategy. So look at, and I say this, but it wouldn't be the first thing. It'd be service drive. Like people come in to service their vehicle, but give them another option to liquidate and make it to where it doesn't feel that like grimy sales type of situation. The other one would be going direct to consumers with private party acquisition, so that you create a safe space, a secure space, and a pleasurable space for people to sell their car, so they don't have to deal with putting their car on like the Facebook Market Exchange or things of that nature and hope to get the right deal. They then can then trust the dealership model or that model to come in and sell their car as well as buy a car.
From a marketing perspective, is there, do you have suggestions for dealerships to message that that is what they're up to reframe the conversation about acquisition first? How would you suggest they market that so that the wider consumers understand that they are now a buying option?
Yeah, so what I focus on and what I would tell every dealer to do is that you have to create a really great why sell to me message. So if you go to any store, they'll tell you why should you buy from them, and they all say something to that variety. You have to, from a marketing standpoint, create that why sell message, and then you need to create a different dynamic. So for instance, if you're a Toyota store, and let's say you're just Joe Smith Toyota, that's all well and good. People know that, but you need to create a buying center or a liquidation center that is its own business model within the same building that people can then start researching, find on online, Google, Bing, things like that, social media, to where they can see that there is an alternative to just coming in and buying a car from you, that they then can come sell it, much to do with what CarMax and Carvana do, which is all their advertising and marketing is all designed around sell your car to us or we buy your car. So they've already pivoted there, and that's where dealerships need to start moving to.
Okay, so now we've got the consumers coming in trying to sell their cars to that Toyota dealership. And so part of the dealership's making that's a part of the investment, right? We have to turn around and resell that vehicle and make a profit margin off of it. So how do you help your clients learn to see value in those vehicles versus like risk? And I'm sure from the consumer side, you're like, I don't want to sell my car because there's all these problems with it. They're going to think it's a total piece of junk and they're not going to get what they want. So how do you help your clients understand where the value is in some of those pre-owned vehicles?
Well, it's I know it sounds crazy, but there's not a lot of magic to when you create that value consumption. It's a supply and demand thing. It's when we go and get these cars, and now we've created a consumer base, it's a two-stage approach, and one is immediate, and then the other one takes some time. The first one is we're going to go buy cars, and we're going to put ourselves in the market so we have the inventory that we can't find at the auction. And if we're not selling enough cars, we're not getting enough trade-ins. So we're just going to create a bigger market for ourselves. The second part is, and it's the more difficult part of this, is the consistency and long-term effect of understanding the consumer experience. And so when I go in and I train and help them develop these processes and strategies, is we're going to create a dynamic for 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road, where people come back to you because they sold you their car. Maybe it was and they didn't need one at that time, or maybe they did, but now they're talking about you. So then now you have that, I know it sounds crazy, that old school word of mouth of where I can go buy a car, I can service my car, or I can sell it there. You become the full service solution rather than having to only trade your car in if you want to go to them. You're now giving them an outlet to do all three things.
Okay. And how would you, I mean, I think that all of our viewers as consumers have had the experience, and we've seen it on TV about the pushy car salesman, right? That's, and when we hear the word sales, I think our brains automatically go to a car salesman. So
sure.
How do you help your clients and some of us realize that shift is happening and making it not a sales first mentality? Like, what part of the consumer experience are you most focused on for those sales guys, customer service people? What is your suggestion to them to help that be more at the forefront versus the sale?
Yeah, I mean, simply put, and I'm going to use a parallel to a jewelry store I saw. So Jared's Jewelry, like, you know, jewelry is the same thing. It's sales, so they get commissions and things of that nature. I think it's a restructure of everything when we look at how sales is operated. From an acquisition standpoint, we're not going to have commissions, right? These are people that are no different than like a state worker or an hourly worker. They're there to serve the customer, and they're there to serve the business. And that's a unique blend of understanding. They're going to help them get the highest value possible with the marketing, or the market-based algorithms and things of that nature, to be able to explain and educate a customer. And then the customer has a place to where they can go where they don't run into like DMV traps or scams or any of those things that can happen in the private party and do happen pretty regularly. Now, the disconnect that we see with most stores is they don't know how to make that shift and that focus, because they always look at it from a sales point. So if it's not generating a sale, it's not making me money. But that's just not true, because when you get reviews and testimonials and you're building your brand within your community, then people you're giving them a reason to come to you and not give business to the non-franchise stores or the non-community stores. And so people understand this. CarMax and Carvana are acquiring in the high 20% of all private party inventory out in the market per year. And so that's, you know, we'll call it just shy of 30% of inventory that is just, they're just getting. And then that's not counting people that go and buy a car and trade from them. So it's, at what point do you want to take some of that business back? And are you giving the consumers out there a reason to come back to you? And that's what we focus on, is we're building a different methodology to where I don't think we're going to fix the negative connotation of an automobile salesperson in America overnight, but we can create a different dynamic that's more in line with like service at a dealership, where we provide a service to sell your car, and it is more consumer facing rather than what we see on TV and what we know of the sales model.
Okay, and I love that. As you were talking, I had a question. When we do need to go to commercial break, but before we do, I'm curious if, I mean, there's two options, it sounds like, for the business owner of these dealerships. Is one, you either have two sets of employees, right? The sales guys who are selling the vehicles, and then service-based people who acquire the pre-owned vehicles to provide that different experience, that customer center experience, because it is unique to have a shark salesperson also be customer service focused. So it might have to be two people, right? Two separate departments. Or is there a way to incentivize salespeople on the service side of things, right? And like, if it's not making me money, then I don't want to do it, sort of mentality, as you mentioned earlier. Is there a incentivization type of program that includes commissions on the acquisition side of things?
Well, knowing we have to go to a commercial, we could spend hours on that. But the short answer would be, is that anything with change takes time. And to think that salespeople are going to just magically not be salespeople would be kind of ignorant, to think that we're just going to magically do this. So I always recommend that it become two different people. Now, with that being said, is there a way to do it? Yes, I think there's always a way to do it, but it takes a very open mind and a strive to changing the culture in a dealership before you are going to just throw out the, you know, the whole model that you've had before. So it's easier to inject an addition and get that right before we're going to try to evolve everything else, and then put ourselves in a problem where the business might hurt.
Right, which is why, I mean, as an old school salesperson, I thought of the incentivization program. So like, keep their same structure. But we will actually be right back with, after this commercial break, we're going to talk about buying on gut feeling and whether or not that's a gamble or if it's a good way to grow. So stick around, we'll be right back with Daryl.
We are just getting started. Stick around and we'll be right back with more lessons, insights, and behind-the-scenes stories from the people driving real business forward. You're watching Biz Talk, only on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm Emily Galindo, and this is Biz Talk on Now Media Television. Let's dive back into the conversations that move business forward.
Welcome back to Biz Talk. If you're loving what you're watching, don't miss a moment of Biz Talk or any of your favorite Now Media TV shows, live or on demand, anytime, anywhere. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and enjoy instant access to our full lineup of bilingual programming in both English and Spanish. If you prefer to listen on the go, catch the podcast version of the show right on the Now Media TV website at www.nowmedia.tv. From business and breaking news to lifestyle, culture, and everything in between, Now Media TV is streaming 24/7, ready whenever you are. Welcome back to Biz Talk. I'm here with Daryl Steed, and now we are diving into another big challenge for dealerships, buying with your gut. So too often, dealers rush into vehicle purchases without a plan, and it ends up feeling more like a gamble than actually growing. So in the first segment, we talked a little bit about making the dealerships more acquisition and customer service focused. But if that doesn't, not that it doesn't work, it will work. It just takes a little bit of time. So in the meantime, our Daryl, our expert here, has shared with us that they've got to go to auctions. So Daryl, How do you help your clients figure out when they are at auctions or things, you know, and trying to acquire vehicles, that they're not just buying off their gut? What are some things that they can do to make it more of a intentional opportunity?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, first off, I always do everything I can to show them different ways to stay away from the auction because it's just there is a lot of like it's fast, it's quick, and so a lot of the tools you can use, people will still say like, okay, I have a feeling, and or I think this, and I'm more of a facts, data, and science, which has made me very successful in all the dealers I help, rather than feelings and thoughts. And when you're buying with your gut, there's plenty of people out there that are very skilled and they've been doing it for 20 plus years, 30 plus years. And when I go in there, it's not about taking away what they do because part of that instinct they have does come in play on certain situations. But with all the tools we have that now show you market data and they show you what your store's done before and how quick you sell a car, there's no reason to be gambling on when in essence, and that's kind of the change in the business is a commodity, right? Like, so if you're in the stock market, you don't sit there and go like, I kind of think, right? You don't just take a hunch. You're not gambling these big billion-dollar ideas. You're looking at all the financials and everything that's going to move. And that's kind of what a car is it's just a cash exchange commodity that you look at and say, okay, what does the math and science tell me? And so I train and develop and coach a lot of these stores and understanding we can actually come up with really routine things to look at to where I'm not going to say there's no gamble because markets can turn, certain elements, weather elements can change it, but we can make better analytical decisions, which are typically better financially than just saying, well, we needed 10 cars, so I just kind of went and got this, right? It's more of a definite situation.
Well, and we hope so, right? As the consumer buying those cars, we hope that you've put more intentional thought into it than that. So, without giving away all of your trade secrets, what would you say is the simplest checklist that you would recommend for avoiding some of those costly, fast-paced mistakes when buying?
Yeah, so the first couple of them would be is it, what's in this car, like depending on like what's the miles and what's the maintenance records on it. So if you don't see there's been a lot of maintenance, it's though it's a bit of an assumption, but it is backed up by a lot of the stuff we find, is it's probably going to need a little bit more service, which is going to cut into what you can pay for it to then resell it. So if you see a car with 80,000 miles and you look at the Carfax or AutoCheck and see that service hasn't been done in 3 years, you should be estimating a slightly higher expense for the acquisition of that car. If you're on a car with 3,000 miles and it's a 2022, let's say, that we typically see most dealers putting just a standard amount in for reconditioning. Well, that one's probably going to have zero reconditioning or a couple hundred bucks because it's got 3,000 miles. So it's understanding those data points is the first one. The second one, which is a little bit more challenging, is understanding your history with those vehicles and in your market. So we always like to say that, well, no, not at this store. I promise you, we're different. Well, yes and no. The markets can be different, but it doesn't mean that the car isn't going to sell. It's just your market. It may not be the highest producer. So, you'll see people go out and buy $70,000 or $80,000 pre-owned trucks, because trucks are expensive now. Well, if your store doesn't have a good history or a fast history of turning those, then buying those is a gamble. And so it's understanding when we buy trucks, which truck moves the fastest at our store, which brand, which price point. As crazy as it may sound, which colors? Certain colors perform better in certain areas of the country, and so do certain price points. We've learned that, the $25,000 to $40,000 segment is where everyone would like to be just based off payments, rates, down payments. But if you're, let's say, a Mercedes store, you're probably stocking a slightly higher dollar amount because those cars are more expensive. So it's understanding these metrics from color to days on market, how long have they been sitting there, and then understanding how your store operates because each brand is different, but each store is different. We actually have two clients right now that are within 3 miles of each other. And if they stock the same cars, one store will sell them and one store won't. They're 3 miles, but it's a very, the market's the same thing, but one store does better with them than the other. And so that's where you have to understand what does your store do that's going to be more effective for your acquisition strategy.
Which kind of leads me to my question about being disciplined. And I'm going to preface this with all of the different industries that I have consulted with over the years and my experience. I think, and it sounds like dealership owners are no different, whether you're a service-based home service company or a car dealership, but being in business ownership means you have to know your numbers. You have to understand how the process of all the things you just listed, color, what sells, what's your history like. And it sounds like you're saying that they also, these business owners of dealerships are no different, that you have to know your numbers. Is that a unique thing? Or would you say that business owners that own dealerships also struggle with looking at that kind of evidence and looking at that kind of, those kind of metrics?
I mean, I'm not going to say they struggle with it. I think it's something that they've relied a lot on touch and feel, or like feelings and gut instincts, for a long time, because the technology wasn't there to measure and manage it for the better part of 50 years. And as we've gotten better tools and better analytics and better ways to measure, it's now become one of those dynamics to where some people have embraced it and learned it. And so those are the stores that you see are doing very well. And then you see some stores that are still in the, this is how we've always done it. And so they're seeing that struggle. But yeah, it is exactly like almost every other business. It requires one, discipline, two, consistency, which is probably the biggest change or the biggest difference between some businesses and the auto industry. Is the auto industry, when something, it is a typically a very reactive business. So when something goes wrong, we're throwing everything out and doing something completely different rather than making subtle changes or being proactive. And that's where what I do in coaching is, we're going to break the mold or break the status quo to essentially make it to where we're going to be very consistent, and we're not going to abandon this, because the only way we're going to get the results we want is by managing, measuring, and not doing the gut feels, and actually creating a business model that requires discipline and consistency.
And you had mentioned, I think probably before the show started while we were chatting, but and just mentioned now, that technology and having these reporting to be able to make these types of intentional decisions, right? And not go off the gut feeling. If a dealership has not implemented any kind of technology or CRM or tracking system, is that something that you A, would help them with, and B, be the most important thing that you think that they should be taking on right now?
Oh yeah, if they don't have it, we would definitely be having a conversation if you need to have one of these tools. We haven't even talked about how AI is starting to influence things, because that'll take time, but with the tools, you have to have one. And if they don't have one, I'm pretty well versed and certified in a lot of these different tools, because I stay up with a lot of these trainings. But if they don't, it's like they'll say, well, we can't afford it. Well, we're now in that kind of dynamic, is when you say you can't afford it, you're probably spending more money on these gambles than you are on the tool that would actually insulate your business. So it is a definite thing that you have to have in today's dynamic of this market and how fast it moves.
All right. And with that, if people needed to get a hold of you because they have no idea about anything to make help their business, but you're the man, how can they get a hold of you to be able to help?
They can contact me via my website, which is www.smartwolfconsulting. I also have another one that's www.autostreetsmarts, which is the background you see. And then anywhere social media, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok, if you put in Smart Wolf or you put in Daryl Steed, you'll find it. Or you can just contact me via email, which is daryl@smartwolfconsulting.com.
Perfect. Well, coming up next, why numbers matter, but it's the human stories that actually move markets. So you won't want to miss this. We'll be right back.
We are just getting started. Stick around and we'll be right back with more lessons, insights, and behind the scenes stories from the people driving real business forward. You're watching Biz Talk, only on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm Emily Galindo, and this is Biz Talk on Now Media Television. Let's dive back into the conversations that move business forward.
Welcome back to Biz Talk. I'm again here with Daryl Steed, and for our final segment, we're talking about something often overlooked: humanity in the process. Too many dealerships focus only on the numbers and the metrics, which we just talked about before the commercial break, and how to use technology and how to measure things and look at how to sell items. But part of that is we are missing the people part and their stories. And so we're going to talk. So, Daryl, let's talk more about the people who actually make these sales happen, right? Our team members and the critical stories of their wins, their losses. How do you approach dealership owners and helping them with their team and getting them involved?
Yeah, when it comes to our people, this is something I get, we'll say, spirited about, because, you know, we have this issue just in society in general of like thinking everybody's replaceable at their job. And for me, I don't want to say it's hurtful, but it's kind of upsetting to think like, okay, we don't look at our people as like an extension of us, or like as a like family, or like putting it together and helping them out. We look at it as like, okay, how can I get this done cheaper and faster? And when I look at it is, when you do it the right way, and I go and talk to these owners, is we need to embrace our people and we need to make them the reason people come here, because at the end of the day, we all sell cars, we all buy cars, we all service cars. Now, they might have a different emblem on them, but it the thing that keeps us different, or that the differentiator and experience, is our people, because of their personalities and what they bring to the table and their level of care and commitment. And it wouldn't matter what technology we have, if the people weren't involved, then it just comes down to price. And at the end of the day, if it's just price, you have to be the lowest.
Right. That's creating that extra value. And the value is that relationship between the person helping the consumer. And people are more, would you agree that people are more willing to pay a higher price if they have an emotional tie into whether it be the person that's helping them, or that they are invested in that consumer and their experience?
Well, yeah, I mean, we see it every day. And I love using this analogy because I live on the West Coast. So if you've ever been to a Nordstrom's, not a Nordstrom's Rack, but a Nordstrom's, you will pay 35, 40 bucks more for the same tie you probably could go hunt down somewhere else. And it's because when you walk in there, your credit score doesn't matter. What you do doesn't matter. They make you feel like you are the only person like around, and they give you that level of service. They ask questions. They really put that consumer experience to an upper level echelon, and you pay for that. Even though you probably could spend a little bit more time, or you could go to a different store and maybe find it, the time and attention, because everybody wants to feel that center of attention. So I really emphasize that. And I even go one further with the people is, and this is where the conundrum starts and where a lot of people start seeing when I am coaching and developing this, is you think about your store and you're like, okay, you have a brand and you've got it on TV and you've got it on billboards and you've got it online, and that's great. And maybe you have your people on your website. Maybe you don't, because that's always one of these weird things with stores. Some people will put them on their site, some won't. But can I find your people on social media? Can I find your people anywhere online? And are they talking about what they do? And why that is kind of this unique thing is, if I said, hey, I'm talking to you, and I said, hey, I'm looking for this, and you didn't tell me what you did, and like I found out from someone else, I'd be like, wow, so I'm surprised that she's not talking about it. Does she not like what she does? Is she ashamed of what she does? And that's where we have to take care of our people. If we're taking care of them and we're empowering them and we're educating them and putting them in a position to win, they're going to want to talk about what they do. But when we treat them as a replaceable factor, they don't talk about what they're doing, which means that it's actually devaluing your brand overall.
Interesting. And so, I mean, we are seeing in the marketing world that we want to know who we're doing business with. We're seeing that in long form podcasting. We're seeing that in you're looking at Enron's new CEO, who's doing all of these funny TikToks trying to rebrand and create that. And I don't know if you saw the Australian car dealership guys. Have you seen their?
Yeah.
It's working, right? Like, that is because they're having a good time. It appears that they are enjoying what they do, and it's clear that they are having fun, which means that they enjoy their job and where they work, right? Are you suggesting when you do the coaching, do you encourage an environment like that?
Yeah, I encourage that. And then I really encourage like having the social sphere of your people. So I do it from an acquisition, but this works for sales as well. And it works for almost any business model, is if I'm saying I'm going to sell my car to you, or I'm going to buy a car from you, we know people spend hours upon hours searching or researching. And we know they spend I think it's 4.8 hours a day on their phone that doesn't have to do with phone calls, right? Social media apps, things of that nature. So if I'm going to go and sell my car, do business with you, and then I see, okay, I get an email from Daryl, and then I go maybe see what he looks like, or I'm going to go see the, and I can't find you. We've heard from customers, we've surveyed them. They immediately, that trust factor goes down because they want to take a peek into who you are and they want to connect with you. And if they can't, and if we don't give that experience, then we're almost amplifying that old school methodology of the dealership of like, it's just transactional. It's just about the dealership. It's not about me. And people, when they feel like they're cared about and that they're engaged with and you connect with someone, not only is there potential for more profit, but it's to get the customer. That's where dealerships are, in my personal opinion, and where I help a lot with, it's where I get most of my businesses. We're failing in understanding how to teach our people how to connect. We're a texting society. We're an anti-connection society now. And it's teaching people how to converse, talk, and connect with people so that if we don't get more customers, we don't really have a way to make more profit or to grow our business. So it starts with that connection to get more, and how we connect is by embracing our people and then showing them the positive things of like talking about what you do in a good way, not as a don't go on there and do all these videos about how you're going to like sell every car and everything. Don't make it all about business, but tell us about you, show you, right? Like you are the considerable factor that's going to help us grow.
And I was going to, suggest, because, well, it's easy to talk about the relationship between the salesperson and the consumer, but getting them in that mindset, would you agree, or do you help your clients really understand how to make that connection with their own employees? To your point, to your example of Nordstrom's, the way that they treat their consumers that way or their customers that way is because they are treated that way by their management. Right. They are real people. They're empowered to do whatever is legal, moral, and ethical. And that's the only limitations on their policies. Right. That's why Nordstrom's has that kind of culture of this is your store. Treat your customers the way we want you to, the way we treat you. So you can't be like, do you help dealership owners understand how to treat their team and how to develop that connection relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I go in and we go over like what it should look like and what I've seen happen in the past and what's been successful. I also will show them certain softwares like a social grenade is one I'm really big on, which teaches people that are, because where do you start, right? Like if you want to have a social audience and be able to embrace that is they don't know what to post. And like you said, make sure it's legal, make sure, it's not going to hurt you and things like you need guidance too, right? You can't just say, hey guys, I want you to go post and I want you guys to do this and embrace this. And then they go out there and who knows what people would put up, right? It'd be pure chaos.
So right. I was imagining a sales guy sitting at this desk posting on Facebook and telling his boss like, well, I'm just doing the thing you asked me to do. We can't just do that.
So you have to give them the right tools, but then it's also one of the things is celebrating them, right? Like, and I learned this from one of my mentors and this is the tough one, especially for the auto dealership, because it's such a pressure plate type of thing, is we're not going to talk about what we missed or what we did wrong. Like we're going to coach to that maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks. Like we'll talk about it and like coach, but we're not going to sit there and harp on that. We're going to only celebrate what we're doing right, because we want to influence the behaviors that we want to replicate. So we don't want to sit there and talk about, oh, we've done this. And so part of the dealership model is then showing them when they get views, let's say they do a video and it gets, 6,000-7,000 views on, let's say a TikTok, they do some weird, dance or something. And they got a customer from it that liked it. And then they income, you want to celebrate that. You want to show them like, this is what we want to see more of, is build your brand. And then by insulating the brand that they work for, right? But they need to have their own version of who they are so that their personality isn't stifled. It's actually embraced by being who they are. Like that's why you want them on their team. Like, and that's really tough for some of the old school managers, because now you can't be I'm going to manage like this. Like you do as I say. You actually have to be more like a chameleon, and you have to change and evolve your dynamics to the person, rather than just having one version of management and saying, do it like this or else, because most people aren't going to fall into that, take it or leave it type of style.
Right. And that all starts at the top, right?
It definitely starts at the top. And if you can get a GM or an owner to be on social media and doing it too, so that you can see him, it doesn't matter how goofy it is. Then people see, like, okay, like, this is, like, it's okay. Like, it's okay to do different things. And it's being celebrated.
Right. A really great example that we have here in Houston is Mattress Mac. He's probably like 90 years old, but he's out there doing raps and stuff on TikTok, and they've grown a huge business, and he's a hometown hero now of this city. But everybody underneath him acts the same way, and everybody has the same experience as a consumer. So it does work, but it does have to start at the top.
For sure.
Daryl.
Not to mention not only starting at the top, is it needs to be one of the things that this is what we're doing. We're not doing it for a month or two. This is what we are now. We are going to make sure the consumers want to come to us.
Yes, that attractive marketing is what we call that, is that you are out there and people like you enough that they want to come just do business with you.
Sure.
Daryl, thank you so much for joining us today on Biz Talk. You've given us powerful insights into smarter inventory strategies, disciplined buying habits, and more importantly, remembering the human side of business. For our viewers, the key takeaways are clear. Focus on smart sourcing, move from gambling to a strategy, and never forget the power of a story in driving action. So we encourage you to reflect on where you can take action today, and whether it's shifting how you buy, building discipline, or sharing your story to inspire your team. And you can call Smart Wolf Consulting and talk to Daryl. His contact information is on our website. He would be happy to help you with those strategies. So that's all for today's episode of Biz Talk. I'm Emily Galindo. Thank you for watching. And remember, success in business starts with clarity, strategy, and the courage to act. We will see you next time right here on Now Media TV.
We are just getting started. Stick around and we'll be right back with more lessons, insights, and behind-the-scenes stories from the people driving real business forward. You're watching Biz Talk, only on Now Media Television. This is where smart business conversations meet real-world experience, where strategies are shared, lessons are learned, and ideas come to life. I'm Emily Galindo, and you're watching Biz Talk, your destination for real insight from the minds shaping tomorrow's business world. Only on Now Media Television.
Welcome to Biz Talk. I'm your host, Emily Galindo. On this show, we explore the challenges and solutions that shape businesses and the people behind them. Today, we are joined by Elizabeth M.W. Trifonis, a criminal, immigration, and family law attorney based in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. With nearly two decades of experience, Elizabeth is the only lawyer in Wyoming specializing in the intersection of criminal and immigration law. A former supervising assistant to the public defender, she has argued before the Wyoming Supreme Court and remains deeply connected to providing compassionate, accessible legal services to the underrepresented communities. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today.
Good to see you, Emily. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, thank you. One issue I think weighing on a lot of people in this country is, and it's weighing heavily on many, is that business owners and families and even workers in this country are in fear of deportation. Even when it's not even a possibility, right? There are some, I'm one of them, who have people in their lives that have what we think have gone through the legal process and still are concerned, right? So I would love to talk about why this fear is running deep, and what can we do to help them, especially our business owners and our workers, feel like they have options, or at least so that you can provide us with some sort of comfort, if it will.
Let's see what we can do. Right. I think the fear of, you know, having your life upended for anybody would be very terrifying. You know, I chose to be in my life and my world the way that I've created it and crafted it. And so to have that fear of this might go away and I might not have that control momentarily or at a moment's notice is obviously overwhelming and terrifying for folks. And also, I think it's a real fear. We see people that are being detained. I'm at the Aurora Detention Center in Colorado frequently. We have folks here in our neighborhood that are detained weekly. So we know people that are being detained, and we're working to have them back home. So that fear is very real, but having a plan and having those plans in place and how to start them at a moment's notice can give us a lot of control and can give us a lot of understanding about how we're going to navigate that next chapter for ourselves.
Okay, and what kind of steps? I mean, you're sitting on the other side of that, making these plans. So, if for any of our viewers or that need an action item, what step can or the most immediate step I can take to secure a stronger legal standing or at least a stronger sense of control, if you will, in this process? What's the first thing we should do?
The very first thing is memorize a phone number that's local, right? If you're taken into custody, the very first thing that's going to happen is you're not going to have your cell phone on you anymore. And I don't know about you, Emily, but my own mother's number is number one in my phone. I don't have it memorized. So to have that phone number locally that you're going to call, that you know as soon as you're in detention at that jail and that holding facility, you know that number. It's best that it's a local number and not a long distance number, and have a couple. And make it so that it's someone who's actually going to answer the phone when you call from an 800 number or a number that someone doesn't recognize, and have that plan in place. The second thing for your business owners in particular, and parents, and I guess most of us have things that we're trying to maintain on the daily, is that power of attorney. Have that trusted substitute who can access, whether it's your bank account or paying your rent at your business or whatever those immediate action items are for that first month. Have that power of attorney in place and have that person, your known go-to, that you're calling them. They know how to access your bank account or your funds or turn on the lights at your business for you, so you know that that's running while you might not be available. And a lot of times we tell parents, especially, have that set up at your child's school. Who's allowed to come pick them up if you just can't today or tomorrow? And having those plans in place will give you a lot of leeway and a lot of room to navigate that deportation proceeding and coming home very quickly.
I also am curious in terms of for our children at school and also as a business owner with employees, what kind of, if you're a business owner who is not in fear of deportation, but perhaps like I live in Houston, and so we have a lot of, immigrant individuals here who are the lifeblood of our economy and do everything here. So if you are a business owner with an employment, heavy employment situation, what would be their step to help potentially protect your business, right? And operation side of it, as well as protect your employees or help them in any way.
Right. In Wyoming in particular, anybody can refuse service to any other human being. So first of all, our employers need to know that our ICE agents here that do enforcement locally are often not in a uniform and they're in unmarked vehicles. So you really are just dealing with customers like you would any other customer. If there's somebody in your business that you don't want there, you're free to tell them to leave. The other thing for employers to know is employees are afraid. And understanding that and knowing why someone might not come to work, especially when we have local ICE enforcement ongoing, that understanding can go a long way for a business owner. I like to tell my business owners too, one small item might be not to have your employees wearing name tags, or maybe not their full name if you are going to have them wear name tags, because ICE in our area are using that to identify people that they may be interested in or might be looking to detain. So knowing you can refuse service, knowing that your employees may be having a difficult morning when we know that ICE is out and about in our town, and then also those name tags are the first three things I would suggest business owners do to protect their people.
Would you recommend that our children and employees or anybody carry their legal status documentation on them?
I do if they have it, yes.
If they have it,
So, right.
I'm going to get very
We
personal and
just
like sending my daughter with her passport and social like passport photocopy in her backpack, right? To help people identify that she's a citizen, sort of thing.
Yeah, I did get nervous carrying my originals around because I'm the type
Sure.
of person who misplaces things because I'll be thinking about some sort of case or work and not paying attention to my personal items. But copies are wonderful. Having other individuals have copies that they know they can access, right? When I make that phone call, my power of attorney person can get those copies or those originals for me. We just had one last week, actually, where it was mistaken identity and we had a US citizen taken into custody. And getting that information to ICE last week was paramount. Being able to access that person's passport and have their wife come bring it so that we could turn that over, do that quickly, cleared up the detention of a U.S. citizen who should not have been detained. So keeping those papers are important. Keeping copies are important, and having your loved ones or that power of attorney person have access to that as well can make things run far more smoothly than if you don't know where you last left it.
Thank you for, I mean, it's unfortunate that they had to go through that, given that they are a U.S. citizen. And I think, and I'm not quite sure where the line is, where ICE has to do their job, and also we should be doing it more thoroughly in a way that isn't impacting the U.S. citizens. Can you share with us a story, a happy story, please, I beg of you, of how you've been able to help and be successful with some of your clients and getting them out of these situations?
Right. So we do a lot of education in the community about how to interact with ICE and how to state with ICE that you want to see an immigration judge and that you want bond, right? If you're taking into deportation proceedings, unless you're subject to mandatory detention or unless you have a prior reinstatement order for your removal, your first contacts with ICE, they'll give you a form, and there's a couple of choices on that form. And we like to educate people on how to fill it out. That form's going to ask you if you want to see an immigration judge. It's also going to ask you if you have fear of returning to your native country, or it will ask you if you simply are admitting that you're here unlawfully and you're wishing to be voluntarily deported. And that's a legal term that I won't get into, but if you would like to see an immigration judge, if you would like to make that determination if you can stay in the country, then you are likely eligible for bond, and you should be marking that you want to see that immigration judge. So we have a lot of people that when they know that form, they know how to mark it, we know within the week we're going to have a bond hearing, we're going to pay that bond, we're going to get you home. For us, it's a long ways away, but we're going to get you on that Greyhound bus out of Aurora, Colorado, and bring you back to your family. And we do that regularly. So disruptive, sure. Are you afraid? Sure. But there are ways to fix it, bring you home. And then in fact, often through an immigration deportation case, we can actually fix a lot of the paperwork that people have not been able to fix prior to that detention. So, you know, looking for silver linings. And we do that every week. So
thank you for the work that you do. And so my question to you would then be, everybody's always looking for that one step, and we covered, you know, the ability to memorize the phone number, right? Would you recommend that if people have that messed up paperwork that we know that we're, that just needs to be fixed, and I understand financially that might be a challenge, but would you recommend preemptively getting in touch with someone like yourself, an immigration attorney, to maybe not fix that paperwork because we can't afford that, but at least have that contact and retainer, so in the event I do get, they do get, you know, detained, that they have a person to refer to from a legal perspective?
Sure. We do consultations all the time just to see what are the options. And sometimes there aren't any options. The system is rife with difficulty, confusion. It's a very layered system that has lots of band-aids on it that sometimes work and sometimes don't work. But talking with someone who's knowledgeable about it to know what your options are and to make sure if there is something that can be fixed, that we're proactively doing that, right? We have a responsibility and a civic duty to, I mean, this is our collectively our country, right?
Yep.
And so having that civic duty and being proactive about that, we certainly recommend it. And it's amazing. Sometimes we get into those conversations where there's nothing that can be done. And people are stuck. There's millions of people that are stuck. That's the way the system has functioned for a long time, unfortunately, from my perspective. But sometimes we get in there and there's a really interesting strategy in your history, and we can make it work. And there's nothing more gratifying than handing over someone's permanent resident card or watching them get sworn in as a citizen after a long journey. It's a very rewarding journey to be on with folks.
Yes, it can be. So thank you again for the work that you do, Elizabeth. And if people, because you are correct, it is a process. We do have, there is a formal process, not, and it's a very complicated one, having been through it myself, and talking with somebody like you to look at all of the angles and understand that process is invaluable. So Elizabeth, if people wanted to have that conversation with you, how do you, how can we get a hold of you?
Give us a call. Know that we're a small business and my staff answers the phone as best they can, but they do eventually take a lunch break or go home. So Please, if you get our voicemail, leave a message. We will certainly get back to you, and we can start talking about what your options are, and we're happy to help.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for shedding some light on this important and emotional issue. And I know there's millions of people out there that would love to, that need your help. And what we've learned here today is that preparation and protection and proactive steps can turn into some strength and some comfort. So for anyone feeling uncertain, know that you don't have to face it alone and that there are legal strategies and compassionate professionals, just like Elizabeth, who are ready to help you. So as we close today's conversation, I encourage you to take a moment to reflect on what you can do right now to protect your future, your family, and your business. That first step could make all the difference. I'm Emily Galindo, and this has been Biz Talk. Thank you for watching, and remember, clarity, courage, and action are the building blocks of success. We'll see you here next time, right here on Now Media TV.
We are just getting started. Stick around and we'll be right back with more lessons, insights, and behind-the-scenes stories from the people driving real business forward. You're watching Biz Talk, only on Now Media Television.